Hey there, welcome to Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so what we do on this podcast is I share ideas and strategies, I tell stories, I share some of those big epic fails I've made. And lately I've been talking to other experts in these different areas and just learning from them as well. And in my last podcast episode, I got into this overlap between social-emotional learning and project-based learning. And a lot of those ideas are going to be in an upcoming book, and it'll be out in the next few months or so by Matinga Ragatz and Mike Cackley, and I'm super excited about it. It's called The Pulse of PBL. Those two have shaped my thinking in big, profound ways on that topic. And, you know, it's something that we'll be getting into. And, you know, I hope to have both of those authors on this show at some point soon. But I really thought it would be important, too, to talk to an expert who really understands social-emotional learning at a deep and profound level, someone who's a true expert on this. And so that's why I decided for this particular episode to interview Lorea Martinez. Dr. Martinez is an award-winning founder of Heart in Mind Consulting, a company dedicated to helping schools and organizations integrate social-emotional learning in their practices, products, and learning communities. An educator who has worked with children and adults internationally, Dr. Martinez is a faculty member at Columbia University Teachers College, educating aspiring principals in emotional intelligence. Her new book for educators, Teaching with the Heart in Mind, is currently available, and I love it. It is a fantastic book, and her work is outstanding. So go check it out. Previously, she was a special education teacher and administrator. You can find her work at loreamartinez.com. That is spelled loreamartinez.com. You can find her on Twitter, and her Twitter handle is at loreamart, so like Lorea Martinez, but Lorea Mart. And then you can check out her Facebook page. It is Lorea Martinez SEL. So go check out her work, and I am super excited to share this interview with you. All right, we have here Dr. Lorea Martinez, and I'm so excited about this because of just her knowledge in terms of social-emotional learning. I think this is such a timely topic right now during the pandemic. And I think as we move into we keep hearing that term new normal, right? So as we move into that, I think it's going to be really important that we continue the focus on SEL. And it's kind of become a little bit of a buzzword right now. We're hearing it a lot, but I think it's important that we remember that this is not something that's trendy. It's not just a new buzzword. It's something that's always been necessary. And I think it's probably going to be even more necessary as we move back into being in a sense of normal, whatever that's going to look like. I would love to start with this question, just how did you get into social emotional learning?
Sure. So my background is in special education, and I work with neurodiverse students for many years. And when I started my doctoral program, I wanted to switch my focus and do a little more focus on student achievement and data. So I worked for a charter management organization for 7 years. First in special ed and then in data and assessment. And during my data and assessment time, I was coaching schools to look at student achievement and really being able to support students to master academic content. But with my special ed background, I always felt like there was this need to focus on a different set of skills, that it was not only academics, and realizing that many of the students that were struggling to be successful with standardized assessments, many of them had academic gaps, but many of them had other kinds of challenges that had nothing to do with their academics. Maybe they got too nervous when they had to take a test, or the test was not assessing what they really knew, and they had a hard time expressing, you know, all the knowledge that they had. So when I did my doctoral dissertation, I wanted to focus on this other set of skills. And at the time, this was back in 2005, SEL was not as known as it is today. So I found a field and really wanted to focus on this. So for my dissertation, I study how to implement SEL effectively in schools. And that's how I came to the field of SEL, and I fell in love with it. And since then, this is the work that I've been doing.
What were some big things that you found during that dissertation process?
One of the things that really caught my attention is that teachers, because I was working with this K-8 school, and we were doing this research as a school-wide initiative, teachers felt like finally they had almost like permission to stop their instructional time to address social emotional issues when they were teaching. So until that point, they felt like the pressure to really teach academic standards and to make sure that students are performing on tests is so high that many times teachers don't feel like they have the time or they have the resources or even this sense of having permission to stop their instruction in order to address issues. And what we know from research is that unless you address those challenges that are happening in the classroom, students are not able to pay attention to your lesson. So you can have the most beautiful lesson and you know, try to do your best teaching. But if something happened before students came to your classroom and they are not present and they are still thinking about something that bothered them or a discussion, an argument they had in their families, they're not going to be able to focus on their learning.
You know, one of the things that I think about as I hear you describe all of that for, you know, your dissertation findings, your background, is I think about when I taught middle school. You know, the student population I had is, I taught the ELL block. Oops, sorry. My phone just went off. Sorry about that. I thought I had it on.
No worries.
Sorry. All right, let me say that again. So I was thinking about when I taught middle school, I taught the ELL block, and then I had a large number of students who were the special education students on top of that. And then I was the only one certified to teach gifted. So I had the self-contained classroom with gifted ELL and special education. And of course, many ELL students were also gifted or were also special education. They were also exceptional learners. And I really fell in love with the idea of neurodiversity, of seeing the strengths in neurodiversity, that exceptional learners aren't just, you don't have to come at it with a deficit mindset. And, you know, I found that there was a lot in terms of what was said academically in terms of the role of emotions in learning, especially around ELL, right? The affective filter and all of that and thinking about that. But I didn't have, you know, when I look back at it, I just didn't have, I did the best I could, but I didn't have the tools that I needed to really implement SEL well. And I think I reached out to what I did know and found some things that were helpful. But I always felt like when I was focusing on SEL, that I felt this pressure with the time, the curriculum map. Where I lived, we had this rigid 4-hour block for ELL students where they had to have an hour of this, hour of that. And there was such a push to raise their academic achievement in discrete skills that I had a really hard time with when I focused on anything related to SEL. You know, I felt this pressure about the time and the achievement. And then along with that, I was teaching in a project-based format, which I think I'll get into that here in a second. But what do you say to that teacher who says, I know SEL is important, but we have to raise their skill level. I'm worried about achievement. I'm feeling the pressure from administrators. How would you speak into that?
Yes, thank you for that question. I think that many teachers struggle to almost like find a reason to justify why they are doing SEL. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that all the research that has been done in affective neuroscience and the science of learning and development shows that emotions are not separate from cognitive processes, yeah. Right? So it is, you know, in the words of Dr. Imordino Yang, it is neurobiologically impossible to make decisions or learn new concepts or like remember information without emotions. They are part mm-hmm. of our brains and they provide important information that we need in order to learn. So what I would say to a teacher that is really focused on student achievement is to say, if you incorporate SEL in your teaching, A, you are going to become a more effective teacher, and B, your students are going to have are going to find more enjoyment in their learning because you're going to be able to find ways to connect their experience, the emotions they have in the classroom with the content. And students need those emotions in order to make sense of academic concepts, even concepts that are, you know, you would think that they are very dry, like, I don't know, physics for me, it would be one of those. Mm-hmm. You need emotions in order to learn those concepts. So I think that it is, you know, we have the data today to show that they are not two separate and different things. We need to bring them together. And now we have many resources and many strategies to show that SEL can be infused in the classroom. So it's not this add-on that you add to your everyday, but it's something that you do. You know, the way that I like to think about it is that this is a lens through which you teach. Mm-hmm. It is a framework that you incorporate in your teaching.
So I would love to hear, what are some strategies that teachers can do in terms of applying that lens or integrating SEL strategies into their classroom?
Sure. So one example that I like to share is with mathematics. And with math, we have these misconceptions about, oh, are you a math person or you are not a math person? And I'm guilty of having said that in the past. Now, if I catch myself and I try not to say it, and especially not to say in front of my children. So with math, we had that misconception that you are one thing or the other. And that's those limiting beliefs that we have about how we see ourselves in relationship to a subject can hinder our ability to fully engage with the content. And for many people, math is one of those subjects that you just get completely blocked. You have a multiple step problem in front of you. You can't think, you know, your brain shuts down. You start, you know, some people, like some kids in classrooms, start hyperventilating because it's so difficult to engage with that process. So if you are infusing SEL in that particular scenario, what you would acknowledge is the emotions that come with that process. Just the fact that it is natural for kids to have reactions and emotions when different activities are presented to them. Mm-hmm. And I remember a teacher that I worked with a few years back that she started by sharing, oh, math, I had a really hard time with math as a student, and this is what happened to me, these were my emotions. And these second graders could not believe that she had those feelings about math. And some of them were like, well, if my teacher has those feelings, maybe it is okay for me to have them as well. So in a way, you are normalizing the fact that we all have emotions. And the fact that you can be anxious or scared or embarrassed because you made a mistake, it doesn't mean that that's the place where you're going to stay. We can actually help kids move from, okay, that's the emotion, you know, like you have the space to process, and then you can move forward and put yourself in a place where your brain can open up and be ready for learning.
I love the fact that you brought up the math anxiety. You know, I came from a social studies background, you know, and I would have said I'm not a math person. You know, I didn't learn about dyscalculia and kind of what I had and what I experienced until I was in college. And for the first time ever really was allowed to use a calculator. Oh my gosh, there you go. All it took. And I would have said, I'm not a math person. And then I taught self-contained, you know, all subjects, and I taught math. And I remember being so worried that I would be putting students at a disservice because I wasn't strong at the content of math. But it was an interesting discovery that my struggles with computational fluency at second grade didn't hinder my conceptual understanding of, say, linear equations at eighth grade. And they didn't hinder my ability to do well, say, in high school trig, once a test wasn't timed, right? Or at the college level where it was fewer problems and harder. And it's really interesting that when I got to the college level doing quantitative methodology, I could understand things like z-scores or p-values. And I still would have said, I'm not strong at math because it is still hard for me. All computation is just always going to be hard. But it's interesting that you said the thing about the math anxiety, because I had heard that, you know, teachers can transfer their math anxiety and the importance of not letting the students get it. And so the first quarter that I taught math, I didn't share that with my students. And finally I said, look, this is what I have. This is how it affects me. This is why I make mistakes on the board. That's why I feel nervous when I'm teaching this. And it was like whoosh, across the board, the calm in the classroom, you could feel it, just everybody relaxed. And I thought, this is actually good for them to see that. And then now here I am at the university and I'm teaching pre-service teachers. And the two things I always hear is if I have them do any kind of math related things, the pre-service teachers, I'm not good at math is the first thing. And when I have them sketch note, it's always, I'm not an artist, right? The two things kindergartners never say that graduate students always do. And so what I would love to hear is knowing how often that's true of teachers and sharing their struggles and the importance of that for students. What do you think universities could be doing in terms of prepping pre-service teachers for that so that, you know, they're not transferring the math anxiety, but instead treating it as an SEL moment?
Sure. So I would say there are like two main things. One is for universities to nurture and support the social emotional growth of teachers. So one of the misconceptions in SEL is that SEL is just about the kids and not the adults. But actually, we cannot teach what we don't practice, what we don't understand. We need to be models for our students. So a big part of being an effective teacher and one that incorporates SEL is being able to develop your own social-emotional skills. And that means that you acquire and develop this fluency to be able to identify your emotions, where you have clarity about the tools that you use to manage, like in the example you were giving, the things that you did to deal with those aspects of your learning that were difficult, how you show empathy for your students, for other adults, the kinds of relationships you develop. We need to cultivate all of those skills in teachers as well. And if we do that, of course, at the pre-service level, that has a huge impact because those teachers are going to see many students over the life of their careers as educators. Mm-hmm. And I think that we don't talk enough about how difficult it is to teach and the fact that we can develop strategies to build our resilience, to keep the love for learning and the love for teaching alive in our careers. So I would say that that's a big thing. And then the second part is how to do, how to infuse SEL in classrooms effectively. So there is a big component of that that is rooted on child development and understanding what are the expectations in terms of SEL development for a five-year-old versus a teenager. But there's a big part of the work that is based on pedagogy and best practices of how the brain learns and what are effective methods to engage and keep students motivated in the classroom. So I think that with those two things, one around nurturing the adult capacity, but also to kind of like teach the technique of how SEL can be implemented successfully, would really prepare student teachers to be ready to go by the time they get into schools.
So you mentioned this idea of pedagogy is a significant part of that. And I want to get to that here in just a second, but also child development. And what do you think are the differences between how SEL should be approached or could be approached at the early elementary versus later elementary, middle school and high school levels? So as we think about kind of, you know, however you would chunk it up, how does it change over time?
Yeah, so it changes, right? Like the expectations are different. If you think about, a 6-year-old ability to manage stress, for example, probably many teachers can relate that for the early grades through this pandemic, when kids are learning from home, it has been a lot more challenging for them to be able to engage with virtual spaces and have those executive functioning skills to organize their week, right? So there is a developmental progression that you would expect to see with students. And in my new book, Teaching with the Heart in Mind, which was released in February of 2021, I have indicators of mastery for each one of those grade levels. So a teacher can come in and say, okay, I teach, you know, fourth and fifth grade, or I teach middle school, and be able to have kind of like this scope and sequence of what are the general expectations for a middle schooler when it comes to social emotional learning. And then also be able to use that information to go back and see, oh, are there any areas where my students, maybe because they were not taught before, or because they, you know, we all have areas where we are stronger and areas that we need to grow, then you can differentiate a little bit more your instruction based on what you see your students are at.
So when we think about the pedagogical side, I'm curious what, you know, for a large part of my audience and the people that listen to this podcast are into things like project-based learning, inquiry-based learning, authentic projects. And where do you think SEL can fit into the teacher that's, you know, doing collaborative projects with students?
Thank you for asking that, because I see so many connections with mm-hmm. with project-based learning and just using cycles of inquiry as a methodology. So the beauty of any of those types of learning is that it asks students to use all of their social emotional skills. Mm-hmm. So if you think about, you know, students working together to decide, you know, the research topic that they're gonna, you know, select for their trimester, for example, they're gonna need to develop their empathy and understanding of the perspectives of others, for example. Mm-hmm. Or what happens if, a classmate says, oh, I don't like your idea. The emotions that come with that, maybe feelings of rejection, how you negotiate when you are trying to make a decision. All of those components have a social emotional learning foundation. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that those methodologies like project-based learning are used more and more in classrooms as a way to enhance students' social-emotional skills, because it really puts students in situations where they're going to be practicing. They're going to have so many opportunities to put those skills into place.
Yeah, it would almost seem like you have this reciprocal relationship, right, between if social-emotional learning is happening and that's strengthened, then I'm imagining project-based learning is going to work better, right? They're going to give and receive feedback. I think about design thinking, the ability to empathize with the, you know, your audience and who you're creating for, resilience and revision and perseverance, but also those elements of executive function and being able to track your own learning and monitor and metacognition. But then it also seems like as you practice those things in something like PBL, then your SEL skills, you know, your social emotional learning improves as well. And it just becomes this cycle where both of those things are improving each other.
Exactly. And in a way, like any PBL project is almost like a microcosmos of life, right?
Yeah.
Because there are so many different roles that you have to play, and you know, you are sometime, maybe you're a leader, a contributor, all those different things are going to happen. So I think that if you are teaching students the process, like how they are going to engage, you also need to teach them what are the skills that they will need in order to be successful. And those skills are SEL skills. Therefore, as a PBL teacher, you can do maybe a little bit of direct instruction of like, okay, these are some, you know, skills that you're going to need for this project, and then let students and watch students as they engage with the project really practice and notice if students are using the strategies that you taught in class. So for example, you can, you know, I'm sure that PBL teachers use some kind of observation protocol to see how projects are going. You can incorporate SEL skills in that observation protocol and notice if students are, you know, negotiating the life of the project using their SEL skills.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I can imagine where, you know, that could even be, you know, applied to things like the exit slips and student surveys that you do and kind of getting a pulse check of how students are doing. I mean, there's so many different areas where I imagine that could be implemented. When we think about SEL, it's something that a lot of people are talking about right now. Why do you think that the pandemic has shown such a spotlight on this idea?
Yeah, so what we have seen is as the pandemic has really impacted students' mental health, not only students, but also educators. The fact that, you know, students have been at home, isolated from social contact, having to learn through a different means that they were used to. So that's one side, but we have also seen the pandemic has had a huge impact on food security, parents losing jobs, losing loved ones, right? And the grieving through those situations. So all of that in combination, we have seen that the stress level for students has increased significantly. And also the stress level for students. So as schools are trying to reopen their campuses and trying to think about how we respond or continue to respond to this health crisis, the mental health and SEL as a vehicle to address that need comes into play. So schools are really thinking about how to support students and support the adults going back to campuses and buildings by offering, you know, support, and support that I would argue was needed before. This is I think the pandemic in part of it has highlighted inequities that existed before we knew about the existence of COVID-19, and we knew that students that needed additional supports were not receiving support in their school. So I think that it just now it's clear, and it has brought it to light, and it has highlighted things that were there before.
Yeah, I keep thinking about there's these things that teachers have done for students during the pandemic that I hope could become practices later, you know, like letting students resubmit work. Like, why did it have to be a pandemic to get there? Or, you know, I know in my last school district, grit was a big concept and, you know, holding students to high standards. But I used to say, you know, you can't have grit unless you allow slack. And like, I will hold students to a high standard, but allowing them to make mistakes and allowing them to grow and is actually not lowering standards. It's raising the standards rather than just averaging scores. And, you know, and so it's been this thing that my hope is that people will say, hey, some of the things, the strategies that we implemented during this pandemic that actually focused on meeting students where they were at, hopefully we'll be willing to do that when we get back to post-pandemic, post-quarantine teaching.
Absolutely. And something that I have seen is how teachers have emphasized the importance of maintaining that emotional connection to have that relationship with students. And educators have gone beyond what was expected of them. I know teachers are like texting with students late at night. They are, you know, answering a ton of emails. They are there for their students. And the fact that we couldn't be together in the same physical space has meant that we were so needing, or we were so hungry for that social connection and that relationship. And, you know, luckily we have been able to use technology as a tool for connection. And I think that's something that we should continue to hold on, you know, the truth of the importance of relationships and that connection, that it doesn't need to be related to academics all the time, right? Yeah. I know that many teachers have enjoyed sharing their pets with their classes and students sharing their, you know, pets and family members and, you know, their staff animals. I think that there is something about just coming to classroom like as a full human with all the aspects of your life, right? And I think that for educators being able to just show up as they are, it's as important as it is for the kids, right? We are all trying to do this together, and we should be able to come to the table as fully human.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you mention that you know, it doesn't always have to be academic, because there are, you know, it's interesting. I look back at it and I think I used to feel guilty about the fact that we had, you know, I had a like visual puns, like I call them, you know, dad jokes on that I would sketch out on the board. And it was a source of laughter, and kids would start drawing their own and creating on the board. And, you know, we had inside jokes within the class, or we had, you know, show and tell every Monday morning. And I remember someone finally said, you know, I was feeling guilty about it, feeling bad about it. And someone said, look at your attendance on Monday morning and just compare it to the rest of the grade level. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, it's getting them excited. It's getting them showing up. Show and tell is 35 minutes and at the beginning of Monday. And that feels like a waste of academic time. But then it was this realization of actually it's an investment, right? Because if you have students showing up and wanting to be there, then you're not wasting time, right? Like, and that's a really hard paradigm shift. And I would feel like I was getting away with something when really what I was doing was just a good practice, right? It was actually something I shouldn't have felt guilty about.
And following up on that, because I think that's such an important point, that as educators, we have these mindsets, right? And we have these frameworks that we use that I don't know where we picked that up, because I was in the classroom and I was guilty of the same thing, of like having this like laser focus on the academics. And the thing is that when we spend the time to engage in an activity where students are coming and we have that connection, that has an impact on the brain's ability to learn, right? Mm-hmm. And there is something about engaging students, and many times teachers have used the traditional thread, I would say, of like, if students ask, why are we learning this? And teacher says, oh, because this is going to be on the test, right? And we thought somehow that that was a motivator. Students were going to, you know, study because it was going to be on the test. And the thing is that if we are driving our teaching by fear, students won't learn, right? Like, fear is one of those emotions that shuts the brain down. It puts us on a survival mode. So we cannot have, you know, our brain is closed to learning. But if we are leading our teaching with curiosity, and I love that, you know, your podcast is around creativity, that's when the brain is open for learning. Then we are ready to learn. We are ready to engage. And students who feel that connection will go further in order to show you that they can do it, right? And if you hold those high expectations, they will do the work because they want to have that connection with you.
I love that point. I would love to hear, you know, you mentioned how this looks in terms of, you know, a part of SEL is the student relationships, you know, getting to know your students. A part of it is pedagogy, and part of it is knowing human development and making sure things are developmentally appropriate. But it would seem like there's another part of it as well that would come down to sort of classroom culture and peer interactions and what you've done there. So what are some strategies that teachers can do to promote social emotional learning within the larger classroom culture that they have?
Yes. So if you look at, you know, like in general, the competencies, there are many opportunities to use activities to build that sense of community. And I think that the relationship skills probably is one where we can see that more clearly. The other thing that we didn't talk as much is that SEL brings an opportunity for students to engage in some self-discovery, right? To know who they are in the fullness of their identities, their cultural backgrounds, their values, their race, their ethnicity, their gender orientation. When we embrace SEL, we are creating this space for students to bring, you know, their full humanity with all that variance. And I feel like that's a place when you really can start to implement activities and dynamics where students get to know each other and appreciate each other, where you have, for example, you use gratitude practices where students can share something that they are grateful for in their classroom, or it can be in their lives. And really creating space for students to connect with each other. And again, it can be the SEL time, but those opportunities for connection can happen throughout, where, you know, at the end of the day, you can say, okay, my students, and this is a question that I ask teachers often, is how do you want students to feel in your classroom? And then look at your teaching and see, is your teaching supporting those feelings?
Yeah.
And if that's not the case, how can you change and adapt and modify your teaching so you are really nurturing those feelings? And I think that goes back to your question of really creating environments where students feel supported and feel safe, where they can come together as a community and they have a sense of belonging. And all those concepts have huge implications also for academic achievement, as well as for their sense of worth and their well-being in the long term.
Yeah. One of the things I'm struck by as you describe that is just how many of these things are interrelated, right? So, you know, I'm thinking about like Genius Hour fits so well with that idea of self-discovery and sharing your interests and, you know, and then the collaboration, and I mean, all of these different things kind of intersect in a beautiful way. And one of the things too is I imagine at some point there's also the systemic level, right? The structures and systems that support it. So what do you think are some things that either, you know, classroom teachers or school administrators could do in terms of the systems and structures of school that would be more SEL friendly?
Yes. Thank you for asking that. I think that, you know, I like to look at STL from, you know, first starting from the individual and then moving, you know, to the classroom and then the school level and then to our communities. And there are certain structures that have been in place that have been very harming to students. For example, our discipline policies. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where STL has a big place, right? So we, from the STL perspective, we see behavior as communication. So when students are making a bad choice or they are displaying challenging behaviors, they are communicating something. And our mm-hmm. jobs as educators is to go deeper and look beyond that behavior and say, okay, what is it? What is the need that this student has that it's not being met either through the classroom or the school as a whole? And when we look at that discipline policy, when we are like, you know, going straight to punishing students for misbehaving, that is a missed teaching opportunity from the STL standpoint. Because if a school embraces STL, you are leading through healing relationships. You want students to have those authentic connections, and they are part of the community. You are a family. So you wouldn't, you know, punish a family member. You would try to, you know, work on that relationship so there mm-hmm. can be a place where both parties can come together in agreement and to share space. So that's a big structure that I think could be improved through STL by incorporating restorative mm-hmm. practices.
Yeah, it seems like too, just certain, some of them are sometimes just even minor tweaks to the rules. I mean, I remember a moment where we had our principal, Raul, and he said, I want, we have a real issue right now where referrals are going up, you know, they're higher than they should be. He wasn't comfortable with it. It seemed like minor things that were going on. And he just tracked the data and said, look, it's happening early in the morning. It's happening right before lunch, it's happening at the end of the day. So one of the first things we're going to do is we're going to move breakfast from the cafeteria to the classrooms. Everybody gets breakfast anyway. It's just going to be available. Well, and you know, people were really nervous about the 10 minutes of added breakfast and the lost academic time and the change to the schedule. And then the other thing was, you're allowed to have food. Like, we're going to have extra food and students can eat. It's just a small thing. Students can eat, staff can eat. And, you know, that small tweak to the rules, you know, the way things had always been, no food or drinks in the classroom. There are big signs telling you that when you walk in, which, to be honest, I was always critical of that rule because teachers often didn't follow it themselves. Right. And I remember, you know, certain teachers had a really hard time with this rule change. But they would be the first people to say, ah, I'm hangry right now. You know, and it's like, well, if you're a fully self-regulated adult feeling hangry and you're edgy walking into the staff lounge or you're edgy going, then maybe an adolescent with a faster metabolism and in some cases coming from food scarcity might just need some food. And it was like, it was a small tweak to the system and structure that made a huge difference on discipline. But it was a reminder of going back to what you said, that you can't change the structures and systems without also changing the mindsets, right? And so what would you say to that teacher who is kind of stuck in a mindset where they're really resistant to changing things in a way that would allow for better social emotional learning?
Yeah, so there are... Resistance is actually, if you're experiencing resistance, that's giving you data, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's something in you that is pushing against that change, right? So the first thing that I would say is, okay, try to see where that's coming from for you. And many times with resistance, we are afraid of losing control.
Yes.
Right. So yeah. If that's the place where it is, then you can just, it's kind of like you look at it in the eyes and you just acknowledge that that's where your resistance is coming from. And the minute that you do that, guess what? the resistance melts a little bit, because then suddenly you have the core of where this is coming from, and then you can work with it. So that's one thing. Then I would say it's like asking who's benefiting from those rules, and are those rules thought for the benefit of the community, or are they random rules that we have in place just because we need to be organized, right? I think many times we get into this habit of not questioning why things are the way they are. And actually, many of the methodologies that we were mentioning earlier, like design thinking and PBL and other types of cycles of inquiry, what they do is question things that we take for granted, or things that are so part of our everyday life that we don't even see them, right? So I think that SEL brings that opportunity to say, okay, if this is a rule that we have and this is not working, well, what is the reason? And can we find a way to switch it that is going to be, that is going to support the goals that we want, right? Back to the question of how do you want students to feel? And again, I think that many times we get caught up on either our own resistance, because changing is difficult. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is, resistance is related to our own feelings. Sometimes we need more information, and that's why we are resisting a change. But many times it has an emotional component. So if you have an educator who's versed in SEL and is working actively on developing their own capacity, this would be a place where they could easily look at that resistance and say, oh, okay, there's something here for me to learn, and there's something that I can do to change.
So you mentioned your book earlier, and I would love for you to, just as a final piece here, what are some of the main topics covered in your book, and just kind of give us a little preview about it?
Yes. So many topics we actually already discussed, which I'm really excited. So the book is called Teaching with the Heart in Mind, and is a complete guide for social emotional learning. And I can relate to what you were saying earlier, John, the fact that there's so much that you didn't know when you were in the classroom around SEL. And I felt the same way even as a special ed teacher. So I wanted to write a book that would provide teachers with the guidance I wish that I had when I was in the classroom. And it has four main messages. One is the importance of the adult SEL capacity, which we discuss. Mm-hmm. The fact that SEL is not a curriculum. So
yes, yeah.
Right? Like, it's not a plug and play tool or a checklist that you go ABC, I'm done. It's actually this lens to look at the conditions for learning. Mm-hmm. The third message is that in order for SEL to really meet its purpose, it needs to be centered in equity. So we need to look at how we are supporting all students and how we are engaging in culturally responsive ways in our instruction. And then the last one is that in order to do SEL, you actually need like a concrete framework. So HEART is actually an acronym for five essential social emotional skills. So with that framework, teachers can go in, and in the book, I go into depth in each one of those and provide strategies and tools that teachers can use in the classroom to not only teach SEL, but also infuse it in their practice.
So if a teacher is, you know, hearing about this for the first time, and obviously your book is one of the resources, but where else would be a good first place for teachers to go if they're just getting started with learning about this?
Yeah, so other resources, so CASEL, the Collaborative for Academic Social Emotional Learning, that's a great place if you want to have an overall perspective on SEL. It's one of the leading organizations in the U.S. when it comes to SEL. So probably that's the first place that I would recommend people to go. And I also have a blog at loreamartinez.com, and I've been writing about SEL for 7 years. So I have a lot of free content on my website where people can go in and read, you know, for free and get resources and strategies to bring SEL into their classrooms.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this. And you've been a wealth of information and some great practical insights and big ideas for us to think about. So thank you so much for being on here.
Thank you for having me. It was fun talking to you.
I appreciate it.
So again, that was Dr. Lorea Martinez, a fantastic, insightful expert on social emotional learning. Hey, would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? And again, go check out Dr. Martinez's book and her resources. She has a lot of great free resources. And just thank you for what you're doing. Go out and make something awesome.